What's going on, Lime?
Not much. What's up with you, Ryan?
Boy, everything.
Yeah.
And really nothing at the same time.
Everything that is very difficult and then everything that is exhausting.
Yeah. Golly. Whoever thought to make a profession out of bonsai didn't think about it very hard.
It's a lot of professions.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I don't know that you and I have ever... Oh, yeah, we did. We did do a podcast, just you and me, when we did the podcast about you.
Yeah, you spun it on me and freaked me out there right before. Hey, we're going to talk about you.
I didn't do that. You knew exactly what you were coming in for.
I was actually all prepared to talk about water pH.
Oh, you were?
I had, like, web pages pulled up, books, all this other crazy.
Because all of our listeners would be so amped to hear about water pH.
I don't know.
It's possible. I don't know. You know, I don't know. I don't know.
I geek out about it all the time.
No, I hear you. I hear you. Obviously, I can go pretty deep about some topics that nobody really cares about.
Yeah.
It's weird. The ebb and flow of belief that bonsai will grow to be something big.
Deep in my heart, I've always dreamt of a bonsai in everyone's backyard.
You hope for it, right?
I do. Even in my, I play this little game, Simpsons Tapped Out.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had a couple years ago, they came up, you could get a bonsai tree for doing a task.
Mm-hmm.
Every 3 days, you could get a bonsai tree.
Mm.
So I've tried to put a bonsai tree in every yard in my characters.
That's sweet. That's super cool. I mean, you see, you know, it's weird because bonsai, I mean, it feels a little kitschy when it makes it into mainstream, but you see it in movies and in commercials. I mean, you see bonsai everywhere now.
I think it's getting there. I think just people are confused about it. They don't know how it exists. Why would a tree exist like that?
Yeah. I wonder if in the greater community, if people think about it at all.
No, you give them the name and they're just like, oh, I like that stuff. That's cool. Okay. You want a beer or something?
Mm-hmm. How did beer become so prominent?
It makes us happy. It creates a chemical reaction in our brain. Doesn't bonsai
do the same thing?
Not quite as... It doesn't create the social...
You have to earn it a little bit more?
Yeah, you got to earn it more.
I feel like that makes it even more satisfying.
It does. It is super satisfying. It's fun. It's also very humbling.
Yeah.
I get humbled a lot.
Yeah, I hear you. It is, bonsai is a ultimate leveling of the playing field, right?
I'm very glad I live here in Portland. It has helped my growth tremendously and made me like this art even more and more.
It's the right place to be right now, that's for sure.
Heck yeah, man. We are lucky. Whew.
The weather, good. The diversity of species that we can cultivate, great.
The people and the diversity and the love in the people is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's interesting about bonsai to me is that no matter how much it's about a tree, I wonder more often than not if bonsai is actually more about the people involved. Because you can see people that love trees and they love bonsai, and if all of the people involved are sort of negative, or there becomes the connotation or the weight of politics or any of the discussions that surround human interaction and they get involved in bonsai, all of a sudden,
huh,
it's like bonsai loses its joy for people and they'll walk away from it, and they got into it because they loved it.
I think that's with every hobby.
You think so?
I have that in the Timbers Army. I fight so much. I'm trying to keep politics and all that stuff separate from it. It's supposed to be our unifying factor that we support this football team and / soccer team.
There you go. For all the North American listeners out there. Right.
And then people want to bring all these politics into it. And I'm just like, guys, aren't we supposed to unify each other at some point? And
yeah.
Bring all this other garbage and luggage and crap in there, and isn't all that stuff supposed to be left to the side?
Yeah.
I have to say, you know, one of the things that happens in the studio a lot is our, who we are, our, our gender, our sexual orientation, who, what level we are, where we're at, all gets left at the door. And everyone here is just, all the students are just so joyful to be here and excited. And I feel so much of it gets left behind.
Yeah.
We're pretty blessed to be here and see that. But there are places where it's not quite like that.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. I mean, I think, boy, I never, you know, for me, I remember when I started Mirai, I thought about having a sign that was at the door that said all, you know, all belief systems get left here, more or less, you know, and like trying to limit the conversation or at least be an impediment to the sort of that increasing inferno that becomes a political, religious, or whatever, you know, stance, social stance on something, that it didn't penetrate the doors of Mirai. And that's really,
it's spiritually at the door.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that, because I do feel like we've worked really hard to create a very neutral, safe space for everybody to do bonsai. And that sounds, you know, like saying a safe space sounds super weird. Sounds very, very
I don't
Portland.
Like that word. It's very Portland, but it is. Yeah. I mean, I know that there's a bunch of people I don't agree with on political stuff or life or whatever kind of thing. But man, when we get here, we're just all friends.
Yeah. It's just about bonsai. Yeah.
It's about, well, not even bonsai. It's like we get into the bonsai and then we realize, oh, we're friendly people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we like each other.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're a sweet, good hearted person. Oh, mm-hmm. I like you.
Yeah.
And we can settle. We find out who we really are and we bond each other. And mm-hmm. that's what the world's about.
Yeah. Interesting.
I wish there was more of that.
I think that's where bonsai is a unifier, is when it's able to break down those boundaries and have, you know, and I think one of the things about that I have always felt is it's so easy to get pulled into all of that negativity, and it exists all the time, everywhere outside of
way too much, man.
Yeah, and so then when you're doing bonsai, like why pull that into bonsai? Why inject that into bonsai when this is an opportunity to step away from what is the norm? Like, why pull the norm into this thing that you utilize, or that serves a purpose of really providing sort of that positive perspective?
It's become my exit from the world, man. Mm-hmm. We have these stupid ass cell phones now that are in our freaking face all the time. And mm-hmm. I get addicted to this social media crap mm-hmm. and reading all this stupid news, and I get worked up, and I'm like, I get here and so many times I forget my phone for 8-10 hours. And I'm like, Oh my God, dude, man, I'm so much more healthier right now.
Yeah.
You know, you get here, I'll come up on the weekend and the students are all here and we start talking and we'll go out to dinner and we'll do stuff. Man, everything gets put aside and we all become,
mm-hmm.
It's a whole new level. And our levels, I mean, I suck at bonsai. I'm getting there. But man, the levels of everyone here, we all just come together and we meet each other. No one, it's like this non-judgmental thing.
Yeah.
It's just love. Like, oh man, we just love trees.
Yeah.
Oh, I love trees.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing too, because like, you know, everybody understands the journey, right? If you practice bonsai, you understand the journey. We all understand that you don't start out doing bonsai well.
No.
Right? That's not, it, you know, it's been interesting because Hunter and I were looking at, there's a box of old photos from when I was in high school and college over there of all my my bonsai escapades. And I pulled out a picture and I was like, when I styled this tree, it's a picture of a horrific prostrata juniper. And I was like, when I styled this tree, I thought I was doing bonsai well, you know, and it's fun to look back on it now because it's just like, boy, that was my bet. And I remember just the absolute sheer glee, like the giggling glee that I felt when I had wired that tree. And I was just like, boom, you know, I really thought I had done something special. But like, you need that. You need that ignorant bliss of those moments in your bonsai practice where you achieve something that feels good, because that's what drives you, right?
That ignorant bliss brought me back.
Yeah.
I was just a kid, and man, you know, it's being good at bonsai, it's always a goal, but man, the journey is so much fun. Mm. Getting better, and I found the community here, you know, as we're learning together and everyone's acceptance to your level and watching you and allowing you to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes watching some of the students that are more advanced, and they let me make my mistake and mm-hmm. then say something later. I'm like, oh, you like, yeah, man, you had to learn. I mean, you just got to go through that. I'm like, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, thank you for not saying something so that it did stick.
Yeah, totally. Right. I mean,
I got some stitches, you know, now I'll remember not to do that again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Mr. Kimura had that approach with me and all of his apprentices. He would let you royally screw up, like royally screw up, assuming it didn't destroy like a really expensive tree. That was never allowed to happen, obviously. But he would let you sit there and he would just watch you royally screw up. And then he would be like, hey, that's not good. That's not good at all. I mean, he wasn't that nice about it. But, you know, I mean, it was interesting to be allowed to fail. And then once you had invested the energy in failing, when you learn that you had failed, you understand how to redirect that energy towards being more successful. And I, you know, with students here at Mirai, it's been interesting. We just had the Pines 3, so all of our Pine courses are done for the summer. And it's always interesting to watch students, when they work on their own trees, they're plenty willing to screw up their own trees. When I give them trees that are mine, well, all of a sudden, you know, it's like there has to be an umbilical cord there where they're connected to, like, am I doing this right? Am I screwing... And, you know, I always tell them, like, I wouldn't give you this if I didn't think you were capable of it. And I wouldn't give it to you if I didn't expect you to make some mistakes. But if I sit here and I nurse you through the process, you're not really going to learn that much. It's when you make that mistake and we come back and look at it that you invested your thought, you made this choice. And this is why that choice could have been better. Not that it was wrong, but this is why it could have been better. Is where you say, oh, that thought process that led me to make that choice was the best that I could offer. And I did that with every conscious thought that was the right decision and there was a better option. You never forget that.
Yeah, or like me, I go through a panic attack. I'm like, freak out. And, oh, my God, I just ruined the world. Everyone hates me. Oh, my God, I can't believe I just did that. Oh, no.
Yeah.
But that's nice. I can go home to my own collection and then take risks that I feel fine. I'm like, you know what? I'm supposed to take risks on these trees and try things that I wouldn't try at Mirai.
Yeah.
I like taking risk and playing with bones. I like that.
You have to. You know, you have to. I mean, it was just like working with Mr. Kimura day in and day out. I'm not the one who is under the pressure of performing a heavy bend on a world-class juniper, and I wasn't under the pressure of making sure that a repot on a $300,000 tree didn't go poorly. I was assisting in that, and I watched that, and obviously the stress that he was experiencing being in that was conveyed to all of us that were there for, you know, in a variety of ways. And like in now being at Mirai, you understand that stress that you feel in those circumstances and how you want everybody to perform to be able to provide the best possible chance for success, right? But it was interesting because then I would buy a cheap tree online, you know, it'd get shipped to my apartment, and then I would be able to do that without that pressure and stress. And the biggest part about that for me, you know, because I had a freezer box, like a freezer, like a freezer. I mean, I didn't have a lot of room in my apartment, but I had enough room to put a freezer box that I could throw all the dead trees in. And I had a freezer box full of dead trees that before I ever left Japan, I had to put on the back of my bike on the cute little basket and walk my bike to Mr. Kimura's about a mile and burn in the burn pile in the back when he was gone, so that like you can't just dispose of large pieces of garbage in Japan that easy. And in addition to that, like I didn't want to dispose of all of these dead trees, but you know they were small little pieces that allowed me to explore what does it feel like with your hands, what is it the technique that gives you success. Where am I making the mistake in my technique that caused this failure? And I could go back to Mr. Kimura's, you know, and then I could watch him do it effectively. And I knew what to look for at that point after I had tried the best of my ability and my skill level, and I had tried and I had failed. I could go back and watch how he did it in a more proficient way to have the success that he had. And I could take that because I knew what I was looking for at that point. I knew where I had gone wrong at that point by watching his proficiency and sort of that accuracy of his technique. It made it a lot more graspable for me. And then so when students are here at Mirai and that fear to fail, you know, one of the things that I hope for with students at Mirai is that they fail. Now, obviously, I don't want them screwing up the trees at Mirai, but I also am not giving people trees that a mistake or, you know, and I'm not giving them a tree without any guidance. But they, you know, as a practitioner of bonsai, you've got to embody and really take on ownership of the work that you're going to do to a tree and move forward with using the knowledge that you've been given and trying to learn how to synthesize that knowledge and actualize it as an action and as a decision and as a technique and as an aesthetic consideration. You've got to learn how to apply all of those things. Otherwise, you don't have anything to take home from an education, right?
Right. Yeah. No. And you won't remember. It's that chemical implant on the brain.
That tactile experience. You got to feel it. You got to see it. You got to hear it. You got to, and you have to fail. You have to fail at it.
Yeah. I think I'm one of those. There are some people, you know, they read the books and they can pick things up somewhat. But man, not even close.
Yeah.
I sit down and read a book and I've overthought it a million times.
Yeah.
And I screw up things so bad when I read a book. I finally just said, I'm done reading books. This is frustrating me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And end up here with you and Randy and everyone hanging out and then the BSOP and doing stuff there. And
yeah.
Finally, I was like, oh, things are making sense. Okay. All right.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think the books were all we had for a while, which is what's so exciting about all the different vehicles to educate people about bonsai now. You know, it's groundbreaking. I mean, you have a podcast, you got blogs and websites and now live, you know, Mirai Live and live streaming is the next step. And then you've got in-person education, which you can't ever duplicate with any tool. Because you get that tactile experience and live feedback on what you're doing when you're investing that thought. But yeah, it was really interesting. It's been, as always, like when I complete sort of a set of courses going through all the Pines 1, Pines 2, Pines 3, and you see students' knowledge elevating and you see their skill sets growing and you see the differences in the classes and you see the product of the, you know, it's like, oh, okay, we're on the right track. But it is always interesting to see that same apprehension, which I believe is a product of, you know, not wanting to fail, also being respectful. I appreciate students' respect for the trees that are here, and they know what's gone into it, which is another part of getting your feet wet in bonsai. You understand what it took to create something that's beautiful, and then you don't want to be the one that brings it to its demise, right?
Or just the beauty that the tree itself had to go through, the years of life it went through just to get there.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, you know, that's an interesting correlation too to, like, you know, Aaron Packard at the Pacific Bonsai Museum has entrusted Mirai with a lot of really important trees that they have there to help those trees not only thrive, but to take them into a next phase of evolution or development or, you know, improvement or advancement. And you know, even now, I mean, I'm, you know, 8 years out of my apprenticeship, 6 years as an apprentice. And prior to that, I'd been doing bonsai for, you know, 9 years. So that's whatever that is, a long time. Let's just say that. Okay. And 24 years of bonsai. Still, when I sit down in front of a tree like that, I have a lot of trepidation. I have a lot of anxiety and sort of, you experience that lack of confidence. Even now I experience that lack of confidence. I know, like, in my mind I can reason through, like, oh, okay, I have done this before. I know I'm going to look at this objectively. I know that the final product is going to be, I have confidence that I'm going to be able to improve this tree, or I shouldn't put my hands on it.
It's like a rock star. Those trees are rock stars. They've lived us, they're longer, they have a story.
History.
And, yeah, history, story. There's things going on with them. And you're trying to be respectful, I don't think you'll ever lose that. I think it'll always be there till the day you die. You'll have this moment where, okay, whew, all right, here we go.
Yeah. I hope it never goes away. I feel like if it goes away that might be an indication that the time has come and gone.
Bonsai's left you.
Yeah, Bonsai's left me, or maybe the respect and trepidation that you have to responsibly approach a tree is not there. Maybe the reverence is not there anymore. I don't know. Because you can go far past that level of reverence to a point where it's debilitating and you can't take action. And I think a lot of people experience that.
In the beginning, that's very, very powerful.
Without a doubt. If it's not there in the beginning, then
you don't do it.
Maybe you shouldn't be doing bonsai.
You should do bonsai.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was always envious, you know, when I had my little back deck when I was in high school at my parents' house, and I was really scared to wire a lot of trees because I was like, what if I screw this tree up? And it already looks pretty good and it's already this old. And, you know, I mean, this is like, we're talking about nursery stock, right? And I had friends who were like, oh man, give me that. And they would just hack it up and wire it up and be like, I hope that lives. And it was, I was always just like, I was envious. I was envious of the lack of, fear. And I was envious of their inhibition to try bonsai, to try it, you know? And I was always like, oh, I want to try to wire. And I would think about wiring and I would think about trying to wire and I would have the wire and I would have the tools and I would have the tree and I would sit down to wire. I'll never forget. I had a ficus. I was like, I brought it into the house. I had my table all set up. I had my wire there. I was going to wire a tree and I like touched two branches. They both broke. And I was like, well, I guess I'm done. You know, it looks pretty good. I'm done for the day. You know, it was one of those experiences, and it was just it was always really interesting. You know, Japan really got me through that. Japan really got, because I showed up at Mr. Kimura's, and if I'm really honest, I didn't know how to wire when I showed up there. I mean, I didn't know how to wire at all.
You,
I mean,
said
I,
that I've heard you say that, and I'm like, wait, what? Yeah,
but you don't go. I mean, you think about all of the apprentices that he takes on. I didn't submit a portfolio to Mr. Kimura to be an apprentice. Mm. I showed my dedication and desire to learn to become an apprentice, right? Mm. Most of his apprentices have never done bonsai in their life. So that's what he wants, actually, just a blank slate, because then he can just mold you how he wants. I did have to undo a lot of bad habits, which was more painful for him. But when I walked in there, he showed you how to wire, and then he gave you a cutoff branch and wire, and he's like, go wire. And it's just, and then you're like, wait, shoot, I should have watched more closely. I can you do that again? And it's like, no, that was your chance to learn the technique. Obviously that that technique was embedded in his apprentices because we wired 300 plus trees a year.
Yeah,
a
watching
piece,
you wire now, it's like, whoop, whoa, that was done.
Oh yeah. But really, you know, I had the same experience with basketball, right? I wanted to be really good at basketball. And so I would shoot, I think I shot something like 1,200 jump shots a day. You know, I shot 1,000 free throws a day. I worked on ball handling for 30 to 45 minutes a day. I mean, like, I had this whole like thing that I did, right? Because obviously I have the personality to go pretty big. And I could never... I never developed that comfort and proficiency to do all of the things that I would do when I was practicing in a game. Couldn't do it. Couldn't get there. It was a mental limitation.
I was the same way with inline skating when I competed.
Mm-hmm.
I got picked on for it. My buddies used to, I was a choker. We'd go out skating in the street and I'd pull off these sick tricks, awesome stuff, like huge stuff. They're like, all right, dude, we got to go to compete. We got to compete. This is good. And then I go compete and I totally fail.
It changes like, the framework. So it changes the mental.
They're like, dude, you haven't missed that trick in months. How the heck did you just screw everything up?
Right.
I'm like, oh, I don't know. I can't do it under the pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's a very interesting thing. It's like, but with bonsai...
It can be debilitating.
Oh, it's so debilitating. And with bonsai, I think functioning under the pressure of Mr. Kimura was a proving ground, because there's never been a demo where I felt anywhere near the pressure that I did with him standing over my shoulder, watching me wire. And I was, and you become accustomed to that as an apprentice, but really what I wanted in my apprenticeship was that proficiency, or what I, you know, what I've sort of later learned to call as fluency. Because when you're fluent, you don't think anymore. When you're fluent, you are communicating in the language that you're speaking. You're not, and you're thinking in that language. You're not thinking about your native language and then translating anymore. That's not fluency. When you're doing bonsai at a high level, you're not thinking about the technique. You're thinking about the nuances and all the ways that you need to be approaching the tree to be able to actualize what you're thinking about. But the technique itself is happening, and you're utilizing that in a way where it's a very organic thing. And I wanted that, where I had seen that limitation in myself with basketball, I wanted to develop that in bonsai, and I couldn't have done it without that kind of repetition.
Oh, the pressure.
Yeah, the pressure, but also just the day in, day out, when you are trying to pursue something and it's not demanded of you. It's a lot different than when it's demanded of you.
Yeah.
Like if your job, if your job had been inline skating, if your job had been every single day to be out there pumping those tricks, and then you got into a competition, at some point those tricks don't become something that you think about anymore. You're picking your line in the.
I think audio engineering got to that point.
Did it?
Touring, doing audio, I don't even have to think about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just know I can listen, hear things, do things. Like you get. When we did the launch party,
mm-hmm.
I know I look like a chaos crazy man running all over the place, but I'm actually pretty calm in my head. I just know everything that's going down and can point it, do 15 things at once.
Yeah. Yeah. You were in DEF CON mode for sure.
Yeah. I was also trying to impress. I wanted you to be happy. I wanted everyone to be happy.
It was amazing. We may need to do another one of those sometime soon.
Yeah, it was super fun.
Yeah,
so everyone
it really was.
It was great to watch. All of the BSOP people come out and get a little tipsy and start asking questions and having fun. I was like, I love this.
Yeah.
It's our family having fun.
Courage.
Dude, it was great. It was good to see the BSOP family and then just non-Bonsai people come out and have a good time. And the smiles on everyone's faces is
right.
Everything was good. It was great. It was a great experience.
I mean, but when you think about Dean Potter or Alex Honnold as climbers, or you think about Vitas, you know, who's on the podcast, a professional soccer player. I mean, these guys and girls, people that are at the top of their pursuit, the fluency that surrounds their actions and their gestures and their thought process is incredible.
Dean was the one to me that epitomized it.
Mm-hmm.
He always had a smile. Whenever I saw him climbing, if I looked at him through a scope, watching him, when I watched videos, whatever he was doing, like joy emanated from him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just wonderful. Made me want to follow my passion.
Mm-hmm.
Don't follow money. Don't follow fame. Don't follow materialistic things. That man literally epitomized to me joy.
Mm-hmm.
Follow your dreams. Man, he lived in a van.
Yeah, that's the word on the street. He was like one of the best climbers in the world, and life wasn't easy.
He had a house. He just liked to live in his van and run around and do his thing. And like, he'd pop out of his van. I mean, just joy just emanating because he's following something he really liked to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Still today, those moments sit in my head, and I'm not climbing anymore, but it has driven me to become a different type of human being.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I'm doing Bonsai, I'm struggle, but I try to find those joy moments and those smiling moments.
Mm-hmm.
I think watering lately has become trying to bring me back.
I dig watering. I dig it's watering.
It's that moment of, look at you. Oh, nope. Leave you alone. Oh,
yeah.
Look at you. How are you doing today? How are you this afternoon?
I was texting with Peter Warren. He's got a big installation in London right now.
Oh, I saw that installation.
Yeah, super
it looks
cool.
So cool.
Super cool. Really,
Peter,
really beautiful.
So gnarly.
Yeah. And Peter and I were talking about it because we just wrapped up the Future Perfect exhibition in LA.
Yeah.
And with Jonathan Cross. And you know, talking about the nature of exhibitions in Bonsai, are painful. They're super rough, right? I mean, the Artisan's Cup was great, but it was super rough.
There's a lot of work, but man. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's great and all, but for the people that are the experience of it, like I would love for somebody to put on an Artisan's Cup where I don't have to do anything and then I can just go look at it, you know?
Speaking of the Artisan Cup, randomly, was it yesterday or 2 days ago, I was sitting with Newton having lunch at this Mississippi Studios, a music venue.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how we got talking. The guy asked me, like, what did he brought something out. Somehow Bonsai came up.
Mm.
And I said, oh yeah, I like to do Bonsai. And he's like, oh, I went to this thing at the art museum a couple years ago. Whoa, dude, it was totally epic. I'm like, do you do Bonsai? He's like, heck no. Like, I just went to that and just like everything about it, like, whoa. I just had to sit there for a minute and realize, oh man, this is a total rando
mm-hmm.
who showed up to the art museum. And I just randomly found this guy several years later. He's telling me how the impact of the lighting and the trees and everything that was going on.
Nice.
It was awesome to see a non-Bonsai person's like the joy still coming from it.
Years later, still
coming out of him, like, man, that was an amazing exhibition.
Wow. Wow. Thank you for that. Thank you. I needed that.
It was so random. It's so random. I didn't even, like, I don't even know how this guy just said hi to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was cool. It was great. And I think he was trying to pet Newton, and Newton and I were, I don't know, but it can't, the way it came up.
Newton is Lime's dog, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. If you haven't heard him shaking his stuff, his
just
collar.
So you know that Lime's not trying to pet other people. petting your boy Newton.
I'm not petting people. No.
I'm just saying I wouldn't put it past him, but Newton is a dog.
Unless you ask me to pet you, then maybe I'll pet you.
Yeah, you've got that kind of loving touch.
I got the loving touch. If you ask me to pet you, you can give me a pet.
But it was interesting texting with Peter, because he's putting on this beautiful, his trees are being displayed in a really magnificent way in a kind of a glass cube in London. If you guys haven't seen it, Sariyama Bonsai on Instagram, you can see images of that. But you know, we're texting and it's kind of like, man, this exhibition thing is no joke. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of behind the scenes and stuff. And he posted sort of after either he had done a rotation of the installation or something with just his scissors, and they were kind of dirty and there were clippings around it. And is something to the effect of getting back to the workshop or getting back to Bonsai. And in our text, I texted him, you know, like, I'm all about being a backyard Bonsai guy, you know, because you do all of this stuff that's very public facing, but really where the magic still is. And for me, it's amazing if I can sit down in the studio or in the workshop and just do work on a tree. Josh and I were filming the pruning of Chinese elm for a feature piece of content that's going to come out on Mariah Live. And just pruning a few branches on the Chinese elm relieved all of the mental sort of stress and all of the things that I was holding internally. Over like 5 minutes, it was just gone. You know, yeah. It was amazing. And I recognize that a lot of the, and I'm sure people that do practice yoga, which I wish I was doing now, I used to do it a lot, and I got a lot of value out of that. I don't do it so much anymore.
Yoga's
gangster. It's awesome.
I'm not happy with you.
You're not happy with yoga?
No, it's not my thing.
Oh, man. Yoga. Oh, yoga's good. But
climbing could be my yoga.
Yeah, there you go. But I mean, it, for real, like sitting down with a tree and just working on a tree for an hour is game changer for me. And that's really what it's all about. And one of the things that's shifted doing Bonsai professionally, particularly in the United States, is you have to worry about all of the other crap. You got emails, you got a garden to maintain, which I will say, maintaining the garden is not in any way a chore as far as I'm concerned. And I'm very fortunate to have Troy at the helm of the garden, because he does a absolutely bang up job. I couldn't have somebody better watching over the trees when
he's
I'm
a speed demon.
Not able to. He's an animal. He's just the greatest guy while he's doing it all, right? But that backyard approach and just getting to engage with the trees is why I did this whole thing. And during my apprenticeship, you know, there was a lot of grueling aspects of the apprenticeship, because you're more or less an indentured servant to somebody, so you do whatever they ask you to do. But there was a lot of freedom from the responsibility that actual life holds for you. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I went to Japan at 21 years of age, turned 22 a few months after starting my apprenticeship, and I came back at 28 and turned 20. I came back at 28, and the impact of having stepped out of that responsibility for 6 years and then coming back and literally feeling like my maturity level was still at a 22-year-old, yet I was trying to start a business, and suddenly you're expected to know all of these things.
I've wondered what you went through.
Oh, man.
That had to be, because it's like, not to pause, it's kind of like going to boot camp. You know, when I went to boot camp, I kind of just shut off. I just do what I'm told. You just, boom, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. Almost mentally, physically, at every age level, your brain just turns off. You do what you're told to do. You follow your tasks. And then you're done with it, and you're like, oh, what am I supposed to... Oh.
Yeah, what do I do now?
Yeah, I have to be a human now.
Yeah.
Like, I have to think for myself. Crap. app.
Yeah. 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 It's
I've wondered how, because that was 6 years. It's not like, you know, 3-4 months. It's
right.
6 years of like, you got immersed into this world where basically you don't own yourself. You have no ownership to you.
Absolutely not. And literally, I picked up where I left off when I was 21.
That's hard.
It was super gnarly.
It's grueling.
It was super gnarly. And even now, I mean, I was 28 when I came back. I've been back for 8 years. I'm 36 now. I still feel like I'm playing catch up to a degree. And I don't know now if it's so much catch up of like a lack of maturity or anything like that. I feel like now it's probably natural growing pains of just trying to operate a business and be successful at it. And the fact that I chose to operate a business that is based around an art form that I'm not so sure people are ever going to really value. They might think it's cool and it might...
We're getting there.
Yeah, it might have an impact, and I hope so. You know, there are days where I'm like, oh, this is definitely going somewhere. And there are days where it's like, man, I don't know, you know, maybe bonsai is a backyard pursuit. Obviously, I don't believe that. Otherwise, I wouldn't be throwing my entire heart and soul into it.
Yeah, we got Artists Got what Peter Warren just did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a stepping stone. Just putting in the glass, putting in that exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
The pictures that I saw from that exhibit, I felt like was another stepping stone towards, you know, what would you say? You used it. Not the Louvre, but...
Oh, MoMA.
Yeah, like into the major museums.
Yeah, sure.
All of a sudden, now they have to have an exhibition for
this. Yeah,
you know what I mean. Where art critics from all over the world are coming to see these few exhibitions.
Yeah.
You know,
but yeah,
it's on its path.
There's momentum. From that perspective, I think there's momentum that's being accumulated. It's a matter, and I think it truly is a matter of, in terms of bonsai breaking through, is how much of these very painful endeavors that really take people who are pursuing bonsai because bonsai gives them peace of mind or is a passion, how many of these painful endeavors that take you away from doing what you love to do to be making what you love to do available to a greater population, how many of those can you do? You know, how much endurance do you have to be able to continue doing that and hoping somewhere along the line that it catches on before you say, you know what, it's not worth it. I'm going to go ahead and do what I love to do. And almost...
I struggle with BSOP.
Sure, but almost like resign yourself to that role, that lesser responsibility of what it was like to be an apprentice where you just worried about working on the trees. And then, you know, and obviously as a bonsai professional, it's not possible to ever go back to that level because Mr. Kimura was worrying about the things that I worry about now. And he got pulled in a lot of different directions. He was, you know, by the time I was an apprentice with him though, he was so established, and he really, one thing that I respected about him and I understand more now than ever is he picked and chose his moments very wisely, where he was willing to invest energy outside of the work that he had in his garden and on the trees and that he was passionate about. He picked and chose his moments extremely well, where he was going to invest energy, and he was very calculated in where that energy was going to be spent. And I think part of being young and part of also trying to test the temperature of the water is flailing a little bit. And it is that catch up or that evolution or that experimentation that allows you to figure out where you stand and where you want to invest your energy and what you're all about in this whole thing, or what you, at least you want to represent yourself to be. And it's interesting because I haven't lost passion for the exhibitions. I loved the Future Perfect exhibition.
We have to expose people in the United States and in this culture to the trees.
Yeah, we do. I don't know that there are a lot of people that are, you know, and you can look at it on varying levels, and you could have a club show and say 300 or 3,000 people walk through the show. There's a lot of different contexts yet to explore with bonsai.
So I'm going to drag a few of my trees around this summer to three festivals I'm going to: the Oregon Country Fair, Northern Nights Music Festival, and Wave Spell in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And in my camp, I'm going to set up this little display and just let people...
Oh, that's cool. That's super cool.
It's been in my heart, and I'm like, I got to do this, man. The only way people are going to start seeing this is if we expose it.
You're going to have so many people on acid and mushrooms and DMT looking at your trees and just going, yeah, man. I know.
And you know what? That makes me so excited. I am so prepared to sit there and talk to them for hours.
I think I'm
going to come back from each one of them even more excited about bonsai because I just made more appreciators.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very true. Appreciators. Aaron Packard, shout out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I also think one thing that I've become aware of is you have seasons. The trees have seasons to be active, right?
Yeah.
Human beings have seasons to be active as well. I firmly believe that. And it's become something that in Japan, you only ate what was seasonally available because they don't import a lot of external food and whatnot.
I wish we did that more here. I think about that consciously.
I think it's healthy. I mean, I think your body is geared to consume different things at different times of year, and it's appropriate. Like living seasonally is a beautiful way to live.
I'm learning that. Mm-hmm. We don't have that here because we ship everything in all over the place.
Yeah, refrigeration changed everything, right?
Yeah.
But now moving into summer where the trees are slowing down their growth and they're starting to sort of, you know, they're hitting the beginnings of the summer lull. Mm-hmm. And the spring season, you're jacked and the trees are jacked and they're growing and you're excited, repotting, raising the garden, you know, everything's happening. And it's a really invigorating time of year. And then the fall, everything is changing and everybody's gearing up, trees being everybody gearing up for winter, people gearing up for winter. Physiologically, we're doing it whether we want to acknowledge it or not. We obviously change our body's physiological responses with electricity and prolonged daylight length when it's supposed to be dark. I mean, one of the biggest things about summer here, we just hit the summer solstice.
You know, so excited.
Almost, yeah, we're going on 2 weeks ago, longest day of the year. I mean, it's light here till 10 p.m.
That's great.
It's amazing.
Yep.
It's amazing. But also
into the 5 a.m. light, though.
I'm all about the 5 a.m. light. Give it to me because I'm not awake anyways. It doesn't matter. I should be. Technically, I feel like I should be, and I don't know where that feeling like I should be comes from. But
I haven't been sleeping well, so I've been awake every single actually, pretty much since the solstice, I've watched the sun come up.
Oh, that's great. Good for you.
Yeah, but it means I'm not sleeping very much.
I mean, you could be going to bed earlier.
If I could, I would.
Oh, wow.
I've tried. I even took a sleeping pill the other day.
Oh, how'd that go?
Didn't do anything.
Really?
I was wide awake through it. I'm like, man, oh, man, this is my life stress is it's got to calm down at some point, man.
Yeah. This too shall pass.
This will pass.
That's what everybody keeps telling me.
I think the Oregon Country Fair is going to help realign myself to being comfortable again with the world.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you'll be around good people. That'll be good for you.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting. But to think about putting on a summer exhibition right now, it's just like, nope. Nope. LA was that exhibition was small. It was 5 pieces. That's it.
But there's a lot of stress going on here.
A lot of stress.
There was a lot going on. I could see it.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. It was, there's a lot of media associated with it, which was great and cool. And obviously, you know, sort of the word is getting further spread with a lot of those articles and stuff that came out around that. And a lot of it was based on Jonathan's work and Jonathan's pieces. I mean, Jonathan's amazing. We're going to launch that film about Jonathan Cross.
I'm so bummed I wasn't here for him. I'm super bummed. I actually emailed him and said, man, I'm really bummed I didn't get to meet you.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to like...
He's blowing up. He just had a major gallery show in Dallas. That was phenomenal. I mean, I don't know that it's...
Keep blowing up, brother, but I gotta sit down with him.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring a really good bottle of tequila. We're going to have a podcast.
You better go super high-end because Jonathan's not impressed by tequila, man.
I think I found the high-end that he will really like.
Wow. So. Wow. Yeah, I just talked to him. Well, actually, he just called just a minute ago.
Yeah.
But I took a picture because Josh finished the video on his firing and his pieces, and we watched it today. I took a picture of it because I've never seen a piece that beautiful about him as a crafts, you know, as an artist and a sculptor. And so I'm excited for him to see it. It'll be interesting to see what he thinks about it. But it's really well done.
As an artist, it'll probably bring a huge humble heart to him. And I don't know. My impression, it's going to bring a tear to his eye. I mean,
yeah, maybe. Yeah. Josh, did you feel like that film was emotional in any way?
I mean, like
process.
Yeah. And so it could get emotional for him, but like, yeah, I don't know. It's a celebration of.
Yeah, no doubt a celebration. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, a celebration of someone's artwork like that.
Yeah,
capturing the moment.
Beautiful. And, it's really well done. Arthur and Ricardo took incredible footage when they were down in Joshua Tree. I mean, it's stunning. It's hard for me to watch those films, though, that Arthur and Ricardo to date have made, now Josh and Hunter are taking over the reins of. It's hard to watch those and not get emotional. And I don't know why. I always feel so weird. Like, I can't help it, though. You see somebody just pouring their heart and soul into something, and it's really compelling.
Yeah. Speaking of Jonathan Cross, when I first walked into Mirai, his pots, I was like, that's not supposed to be a bonsai pot.
Right.
It's the first thing that came to my head. And now I'm like, how is that not ever, why, what tree can go in that? Okay. It's like, I don't know. It's a whole new spectrum in my brain.
Yeah.
It's broken me out of my mold of what has to be, and very natural and beautiful, and the colors and the clay and the firing, my goodness, man.
Yeah, and when people see the process, they're going to, I mean, it is really organic how he produces
work. Colors he gets out of the clay. Yeah. My goodness, dude. Oh, wow. Just beautiful.
Wait till you see the film.
I've seen bits and pieces because I got to be here, but I haven't seen the totality of it.
Oh, it's epic. I mean, and he talks about the fire maybe being more inspiring right now, and the use of the fire and manipulation of the fire and the firing process to pull out those colors. They don't come out of the clay. They come from how he's treating the firing process. And it's his, you know, when you talk about somebody functioning at a significant depth, his depth of sculpture now is reaching a level that is undeniable, which is exactly, people are starting to recognize it. It's why he's blowing up, because he has put in that time and has really invested that level of, I mean, I think it's a level of prolificness, prolific production to be able to get to the, you almost have to hammer on a concept until it becomes so malleable that it starts to express itself in a different way. And I think having hammered on bonsai in Mr. Kimura's form and in the Japanese culture for so long, like it became malleable enough to come back to the United States and be able to see the opportunity to change some things or pursue some other concepts that drive the form and shape in a different direction. And that has continued to be malleable, you know, with the addition of a lot of these innovative other artists, you know, Jonathan and Austin and Jan Rentenar, and it's pretty amazing. I mean, and Ron Lang was really the first one that was willing to go super outside the box with the forms in terms of the ceramic body, which I feel like the ceramic body is what keeps it as bonsai. When you start reflecting those traditional forms, it creates a dynamic, and then you start changing that traditional form into something that people haven't seen, and all of a sudden context changes because the container is such a big part of the composition.
To me, one of the things that's been going on here, because it's in its moment right now, is the bald cypress.
Mm-hmm.
You've hammered away at it and hammered away at it. And man, there's a couple that got styled this year, one that I've been waiting and waiting. It is just, it's a whole new look at the trees. It's a whole new look at bonsai.
Yeah.
It's a whole new perspective of a tree.
Yeah.
My mind is so blown with bald cypress right now. I'm just like, my goodness, dude, this is so awesome. It's another level. It's another dimension. We don't need to, you know, what is it? What did Dan Robinson say? 3-2-1 triangle, or 1-2-3 triangle, 1-2-3. It's no more of that. It's some,
it is.
I'm
very
trying to
different.
Bring a correlation to what's going on here too. I see that happening a little bit with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the redwood was the first real big exploration at Mirai of what does it look like to take branches up instead of down, you know, and that seems like a very, very simple concept. And then what guides a branch up instead of down, what environmental influences, what conditions, what locations, etc. And it that really changed everything. And the bald cypress, particularly, and credit needs to be given where credit is due, Michael Fiducia's flat top bald cypress at the 2012 National Exhibition was the one for me. When I saw it on display there, I was like, that is the direction that we need to go.
Yeah.
And not to say that it hadn't been explored in Florida bonsai or in southeastern bonsai in the United States, where people are existing around bald cypress in their native environment, because I think other flat top bonsai had been formed, but it was the most well executed one that I'd ever seen. And after seeing it on display, I purchased my first bald cypress from Mary Madison that had organically rapid taper, natural flat top structure, and then designed the bald cypress that was in the Future Perfect exhibition, you know, sort of as the initial attempt, and then the bald cypress forest, and then the stream bald cypress, and now we've got this big massive one out here, and we've got a few others that are now in the queue to be worked in that direction. I literally can't get enough of it, though. Like, once you tap into that sort of nuance and that essence of the species, I mean, it's really hard to style a redwood like a regular bonsai now. And then there's a lot of pieces of material that do lend themselves to the more traditional bonsai form that are redwoods. And I'm sure there are bald cypress that are the same. But it's almost like my material preference has become, I'm going to buy material of that species that lends itself to being, you know, what has been explored and discovered, which is
I think Jonathan Cross could probably go back and make a teapot again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite positive he's very talented, but
sure,
why would he do that? He's explored a new direction that has created a whole new concept, a new look, a new, yeah, I don't, why?
Well, and again,
you're doing something new. It's great.
And again, when you start talking about that, though, for him to pound that construct that it is forming that guides his process now and allows him the repetition of producing work in that mentality and of that spirit until it becomes malleable again and he takes that next step, that is going to be really interesting.
Oh.
And when you think about hammering on all of the species that haven't totally been explored and making them malleable enough to be able to deviate outside of what we accept as the shape and what we accept as the style until it becomes soft and bendable enough to become something different. What is that next different? And it's not different for different's sake. It's different from the process of prolifically creating and refining a technique until it naturally bends and evolves into something new.
So the bald cypress have got me thinking about the pygmies,
because uh-huh.
I've collected. And I keep looking at one of them. I'm like, well, that can't be regular. It can never be styled like a regular bonsai.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to go. To me, it's got to go in the pygmies, the bald cypress style. It's mm-hmm. got this flat top. It's like it's ready for it. It's speaking.
Yeah. I mean, the Monterey cypress, which the pygmies are just a dwarf form of, lend themselves to that similar
poof
formation.
And they look so cool.
And that's also a product of its coastal environment where there's no reason for the branches to go down.
There isn't. And it's so cool to look at.
Yeah.
I love it when they do that. They have this like linear look to them.
Yeah,
it's
very
so
layered, linear, wind influenced.
It's
yeah,
beautiful.
Coastal. It's epic. Yeah. I think we're so lucky. And I feel like I say this and it's a little bit of a broken record, but I'm going to go back to it again. We're so lucky in North America to have the diversity that we experience
goodness.
On this continent. I mean, it's
especially
phenomenal.
The Pacific Northwest from San Francisco or to me, San Francisco up to Vancouver.
I mean, I think you got to drop down to Big Sur.
Bill, it is beautiful down there. I do.
Well, but that's when you get into
cypresses,
Monterey pines and the Monterey cypress, and you start moving up the coast through all of the just the magic of the Pacific coastline.
It is absolutely mind-boggling. The dimension, the realm, the shapes, the sizes, and what goes on
yeah.
in this area.
Yeah, because you move through. You have pines, you've got redwoods, you've got cypress, you've got oaks, and oaks in a plethora of forms, because once you cross over the coastal hills, you get into the interior oaks, and they look
They're
entirely
totally
different
than
coastal oaks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it is interesting. A student from pine class just recently moved from Bend, where he's up around lodgepole pines in the Alpine, and he moved to
Pondos, lots of Pondos out there.
Yeah,
too.
Ponderosa, absolutely. And he moved to Port Angeles, which is up on the Olympic Peninsula, and he's like, I'm now in shore pine country.
It's so beautiful.
And they're very
there.
Different.
Yeah.
And he just sent me a text. He was up on Hurricane Ridge looking at the ancient subalpine firs, and he's like, man, just really digging this change of environment. And on the Olympic Peninsula, you want to talk about a diverse area. I mean, you've got 11 Grand Champion trees, but you go from a temperate rainforest all the way up to the to timberline on one small tract of land. And you also have a rain shadow, you know, right around Squim.
Is it wait, less than 100 miles off and you still have glaciers? Is it 100 miles?
Yeah.
100, less than 100 miles off the coast, you still have open glaciers out there.
Yeah, the Olympic Peninsula, I still feel like as far as, I mean, obviously this is not news to anybody who explores trees in their greater sort of grand habitat or, you know, the mycology and people who study mushrooms and people who study climactic issues and stuff. Obviously, the Olympic Peninsula is very special for all of that, but the Olympic Peninsula, for a bonsai practitioner, is one of the most untapped resources in North America for inspiration, because you can see such grandeur. You can see the full, appropriate, mature image of all of those trees, and you can go from a coastal influence to an alpine influence in a matter of, you know,
hours.
A two-day hike or a three-hour drive.
Yeah, you can drive it. I did that. One of my first trips when I got here to the Pacific Northwest was up there.
Yeah.
And going from, I couldn't get up. So I was trying to get to Hurricane Ridge, but it was still snowed in up that way. So I got up as high as I could. Water's rushing everywhere, man. And it's just getting up into the woods. And then, okay, let's go down to the coast. And then you get into the coastal area where there's swamp dropping into trees and then there's cliffs and the,
yeah.
Oh man, it was so. It is
rugged.
It's just the change, the huge diverse change that we have.
Super rugged. And speaking of rugged, thinking about the people that logged that country.
Oh,
I mean,
my gosh.
And this is no...
Not human beings. They're not human.
They're
literally bears.
They're animals.
Yeah.
Because to log in that country, oh my gosh. It was rich country. Like, don't get me wrong. If you look at timber as a natural resource, or you look at timber as a commodity, right? That was rich country. But to get up there and to harvest, quote unquote, the wealth, you know, and this is no, I'm not taking any stance on pro or con in terms of
they did what they did. It's over and done with now.
Well, it's over and done with, and it continues to be a crop more than anything now in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, you grow out Doug fir in 20 to 30 years and you cut it and you start again, and it is what it is. But I mean, it just thinking about that pioneering spirit that would push people to that environment and that degree of physical hardship to be doing what they did. And I mean, even the redwoods, it's a little bit more, I would say it's a little more Hilton-like, you know, it's a little more posh in terms of the environment, but still not flat ground, not easy, not without a lot of danger and physical challenge. And
they're out in the nowhere. There's no, I mean, even today, there's not much out there.
No.
You can really get out. It's like, whoa, I'm really, you get on the coast of Washington, go north of Astoria and follow that coast. There's really not much there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like, you're kind of getting out. I mean, yeah.
It's really beautiful to be able to get into that. Pretty much, I mean, it's not untouched. That would be a false.
Yeah, not untouched.
But let's say lowly populated.
Lowly populated coastal area. It kind of, to me, some of my favorite spots that I won't name in Northern California. There's a few coastlines where there's nothing really there. There's not many people.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to travel for an hour or two by car at a regular pace of speed just to get to maybe another home.
Yep.
And you feel pretty secluded.
That's good.
And then you think about people that were out there and they logged this or... Yeah, they were rugged.
Good. That's so good.
So rugged.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, it's amazing. It is amazing. North America is a really special place. And I, you know, one of the things about going to Puglia, Hunter and I were working on the Olive film today from when Ricardo and I were in Italy in December. One of the things that I recognize, as much as I have this interpretation, and if you look at a satellite image of the world lit up at night, Europe is very illuminated because obviously there's a density of population there that exists only on the east coast of the United States currently, and a few pockets, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Bay Area, you know, in terms of areas in the North America, but still, getting out onto the peninsula of Puglia on the heel of the boot of Italy. There weren't a lot of people there either.
Huh.
And there was a significant distance from gas station to gas station and population to population and town to town. And it was pretty sweet. It was pretty awesome to be out there in the olives, because we're tromping through 3,000-year-old olives and there's not anybody there. Like, if we had had a flat tire, it would have been a pretty significant walk, you know? And it was like, I didn't think that was still the case, but the lesser impacted areas of the world that offer a tremendous amount of inspiration, it's like the wild is still wild. And there are more people, and obviously the wild is getting less wild, but really in relation to the urban environments that exist around the world right now, the wild is still pretty wild. You go out there and you have problems if you're not smart about what you do and you're careless and all that stuff.
There are quite a few spots in Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Montana, where I've been like alone in the car driving like, man, if something goes wrong right now, this could really be bad.
Yeah.
This could be terrible. I haven't seen another car for 6 hours. I don't even know what's going to happen. There's no cell phone. My cell phone hasn't worked for I don't even know how long.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would just sit there and wait. Hopefully someone comes with a day or so along.
Absolutely.
And if they stop, they might not even stop.
You're a several-day hike. Yeah.
Several-day hike.
Did I tell you I ran out of gas for the first time?
No.
I ran out of gas for the first time in my life.
Where was this?
It was on I-5 coming back from L.A. with the Future Perfect stuff.
Oh, no.
Taft and I were rolling hard on I-5, and I was down by Merlin, Oregon, outside of Medford.
Uh-huh.
And I've almost run out of gas in that stretch of...
Because you're trying to make the border to get the cheaper fuel, right?
Well, no, because I was coming back north, so I was already past the border, and I don't think about the cost of fuel, really, because
it's constantly in my head.
It's pretty negligent difference. I guess, I don't know. It's, you know, fuel efficient, whatever. I probably should think about it more, but I don't.
It never stops my mind.
I think about, actually, how far can I go on this tank of gas is actually where my head is at. But I was in a rental Dodge Caravan, which is amazing because the seats fold into the floor and you've got more cargo space than any other minivan on the market, just FYI, in case you need to know. I've done the research on it because I've transported trees in Dodge Caravans. If I can't have a moving truck or a refrigerated truck, I will take a Dodge Caravan. It's the van that I've used throughout my travels in the United States prior to the covered wagon and even post when I've got a small quantity of trees. But the fuel light came on right as we passed the exit to Merlin, and I was like, okay, a fuel light came on. I got 20 to 30 miles, and I've got 15 miles to the next gas station. And within 2 minutes, the car just died in the middle of I-5, and I coasted off to the side. Invest in AAA, right? And which I do, and I'm happy I did, because I've never used it, and I've always have had it for 8 years, and I've never used it.
Well, use it that time.
I used it. I called them. They came. They put in, you know, whatever, 5 gallons of gas into the car. They said, let's get you to the next station. It took them 45 minutes to get there.
Tough, but make fun of you.
No, we were playing rescue bots on the side of the road. It was great. We just got to stop and hang out and play robots for a little while, and then they came and filled up, and away we went. But
I bet you the next time the light turns on, Taft will be like, "Dad, you got to get gas."
Probably. If he doesn't, then he didn't learn his lesson. He might have thought it was the best case scenario. And honestly, when you're in population, it doesn't matter. But I started thinking, man, if I had to hike out 20 or 30 miles or 40 or 50 miles, what the hell would I do? You know, because the next gas station in either direction was 8 miles. Walking 8 miles and walking 8 miles back is a round trip of 16 miles. That's going to take you a while. That's not going to be a short trip.
I ran out of gas in Nebraska once in a VW van. And I was like, I'm not walking to the next exit. So I actually trudged through a farmer's field and woke a farmer up at 6 a.m.
Wow, was... A farmer was still asleep at 6 a.m.?
What
kind of farmer was this?
Yeah, he was kind of, I think things have changed. It was more of the middle of the year. He just harvest, you know, just did corn.
Right.
And he looked at me and goes, yeah, that's a pretty far drive, man. All right, get in the truck. Let's go.
Wow.
So
what a nice farmer.
Took me out, gave me 5 gallons of gas. It's like, you're probably going to need that to get to the next gas station.
Oh, you're serious. Well, yeah, Nebraska's hardcore.
It did. I mean, I think the next gas station was 45 miles or something like that.
Wow. Well, I mean, this is the thing, though. you know, driving on the covered wagon across the country, a lot of people discount sort of the central part of the United States as
that. Yeah. And also I don't like to drive on the freeway sometimes. I know that sounds bad, but
that's just you. That's your thing.
That's my thing.
But Nebraska is beautiful.
It is. Yeah.
Nebraska is beautiful. The deciduous trees in Nebraska are incredibly inspiring. Incredibly inspiring.
The cornfields do go a little far for me, but yeah.
I mean, you gotta see the trees in between the cornfields, though. Come on, Lime.
I do. I get a little distracted by the fields.
I need you to get there with me right now.
They're beautiful.
Yeah. I
they're what saved our country from, you know, back, was it 1920, 1918, 1920, was it, when we had the big dust fields?
Oh, the Dust Bowl.
The Dust Bowl is because they didn't plant enough trees in between the fields, and the wind would pick up in between all the fields and just wiped everything out.
Yeah, that's when tamarisk came into cultivation.
Yeah, they started planting them left and right because they realized, we need to put trees down, otherwise...
Yeah.
This is going to happen again.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, when I was in Israel, when we were cruising out to the Dead Sea, tamarisk were growing native.
Oh, wow.
Native tamarisk in Israel. Mm. Was pretty cool. I was telling Ofer, I was like, hey, man, what are you doing? You got to be out here getting tamarisk. I don't see anybody growing tamarisk. It's amazing. These are amazing. They were amazing. They were awesome. We were looking over at Jordan across the Dead Sea. Randy was floating naked in the Dead Sea. It was just the total. I was getting shredded by the salt accumulation from evaporation. It was literally like walking on glass. Oh, it was crazy. Yeah, it was amazing. But the tamarisk, I still think there's opportunity there. I don't know what it looks like to collect tamarisk on the Jordan-Israel border, but you know.
There's got to be some interesting places in Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma area where they've planted them that have been wind beaten. And there's some, I've bumped into cliffy areas or rocky, weird areas that.
Man, there's collectible trees everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
There's collectible trees everywhere. And I will honestly say this, when I was in Israel and they pointed out, or well, not pointed out. I mean, I got to work on several just absolutely magical leucophyllum. And they're saying, you don't know leucophyllum? This is a native North American species. You've never seen this before? And I'm like, I don't know that anybody in North America has ever boneside leucophyllum. Now, I don't live in Texas where leucophyllum is native. It's called the Texas sage. But I was like, gosh, I've never seen anything like this. And it could be my ignorance, and it also could be that nobody's ever utilized them before. But it's just like Randy collecting sagebrush and people losing their mind at these little tiny contorted sage. And everybody's like, ah, this is miles of sagebrush. Yeah, you ever dug one up? No.
We have so much variety.
It's crazy.
No one else has. I mean, we have just this massive amount of variety of trees.
Yeah.
North America is just covered. I mean, yeah. My goodness, from Alaska all the way down here, the variety that we have is, I wonder is where in else in the world has not been domesticated enough to have this much variety.
Yeah.
We haven't been domesticated for thousands
it's
and
true.
Thousands of years.
It's true. It's true. It's a major point. And I also think, you know, there's a level of freedom that exists here. You can still get permission.
Yeah.
Whereas in a lot of places you can't.
Well, I think because they were so domesticated, there's no more, you can't have permission anymore.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah.
They wouldn't have anything.
Yeah, 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 you could be right. Yeah, there's a lot of dynamics that I'm sure factor into that, but it is a beautiful thing. And I just want to touch back on how we started this discussion, Lyman, talking about sort of you and I feeling the weight of personal and you know, there's a lot of discussion in the bonsai community right now about politics, and there's been some unfortunate events that have transpired with some professionals not being welcome to practice bonsai in North America or being discriminated against and stuff. And it's like all of that crap. And I'm not saying it's crap that happened. It is crap that happened. It's really unfortunate. It's really sad that in today's day and age that stuff is still happening. And obviously we're sheltered from the reality of the rest of the world where it happens on a far more frequent and
violent level.
Yeah, violent, and also I think not extortion, but you know, taking advantage of minority populations. But, you know, if you can still move to the perspective of orienting from a positive place when we practice bonsai, that's great. But bonsai will inherently take you there. It will inherently take you there when you look at all of the optimism and possibilities and sort of this unending amount of inspiration that this art form provides. It truly is something that is so magical. And I think a lot about a lot of the famous painters and sculptors and artists in the world. Some of their best work has come from periods of immense sadness, pain, oppression. Those have been the inspiration for a lot of artwork, and it is really powerful. It's really powerful. Art is a dialogue and a way of communicating. And I've always
stress reliever.
Yeah.
Or director.
Absolutely, an outlet, right?
Yeah.
When I think about sort of some of the pressures that you experience in the world, just being human. And we talk about bonsai. I wonder if there are bonsai that are created in sadness, or if that sadness does not exist in the pursuit of creating bonsai because of the nature of the art form. And I personally am not able to sit down with a bonsai when I'm in sadness and in that time with that tree in the same state of sadness anymore. It just does not happen.
I've never been able to work on a tree sad. It always makes me happy.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. You're illustrating the point.
Yeah, I am.
But bonsai is very powerful in that way.
I've tried to think, you know, certain things are transpiring in my life, and I went outside and I just looked at the trunk line, and I'm like, oh, it's like this little tickle inside. Like, okay, everything's all right.
You know what's scary about that, though, is how disconnected we are becoming from that organism of the tree. Not any specific tree, because that tree changes wherever you're at from or whatever you identify or relate to, right? But okay. The urban environment is disconnected. And okay, I've got trees in the landscape, and that might be enough, but it's not as powerful as going and seeing an ecosystem of trees. And it's not as powerful as seeing an ancient ecosystem of trees. I think that's the highest level, because then you start to realize your humanity and the short blip that you are on this planet, right?
I think for the city dwellers, though, as I use that term, there are some trees that, you know, there's that 200-year-old sycamore that's sitting in the middle of a neighborhood. It's been there longer for everyone.
Oh, for sure.
Or like I grew up in Thousand Oaks, California, where we had Thousand Oaks trees where they, okay, you have to keep these trees,
yeah.
You know?
No, I that's what I'm saying. I don't think that it's totally void and not present, but
there isn't anything like going up, you know, under the west side of the Sierras leading up and seeing those oak tree fields.
But your focus in the urban environment is not on that tree. And maybe some people are able to orient and find that level of sort of peace or experience what that organism can provide you. But it's just amazing how disconnected modern society is from the natural environment. And I think you see people questing for that connection again with all of the ways, your cell phone, you talked about how you're healthier when you put it aside. And I think that's everybody is, right?
Yeah.
The amount of anxiety of having immediate email access, text access, phone access, social media.
Overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. And being disconnected from that and having that quiet time. I remember when I was a kid, before the internet ever existed, and summer break, being bored out of my mind. I haven't been bored in, I'm gonna say decades.
Huh.
I don't really remember what boredom is like. And boredom seems to be something that's easily replaced by technology now. There's a lot of value in boredom. I mean, and I think boredom is, obviously that's a subjective statement that I just made, because you could be saying, well, you could be doing something productive, or you could be doing something, you know, something valuable. But also, like, the other day, Taff said to me, I'm bored. And I was like, good. Be bored. See what that does for you. And boredom led to us building something.
So someone once told me, if you're bored, you're not adventuring in your mind enough.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. And that's like foo-foo, you know, talk and whatnot, but like you gotta be bored. Like kids should be bored.
It is foo-foo talk, but it also taught me to explore the unexplorable in my own head.
I'm the type of person that can sit down and stare at a wall for 2 or 3 hours. And that's not like stare at a wall and not think about anything, but like just that time.
I think our brains need that.
Yeah, you got to have time to decompress, right?
Yeah.
And the creative bank that is the Mirai team now is there's got to be a captain of the ship.
Too much creation and the brain stops creating.
Yeah. There you go. That's literally it.
It falls back into repetition
mode. Repetition. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And for me, the other thing that I recognize is I've got to be doing manual labor. I have to be doing manual labor. And you know what has become of Mirai is a constant creative pursuit, because we're trying to utilize all mediums possible to execute bonsai or actually distribute bonsai.
You're trying to direct a lot of stuff here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not so much of the manual. Enough.
Yeah. And there's a catch to creativity that I've come to find, and I don't know it well, but I think that I'm on the right track, and that is creativity without organization is chaos. And so when you have a lot of creative people and there isn't organization, then it just becomes this, it's like a Jackson Pollock painting. I'm not saying his work isn't awesome, because it's awesome, but that's, you're literally watching creative chaos in his work. And at some point people can't, there has to be a structure so that people can follow it. Otherwise it's just chaos. And you only have one or two pieces of art that you look at that's chaos in a house that has structure, right? So if your whole business is chaos, I don't know what that would look like. I mean, maybe I'm trying to like over-organize or something, and I'm not organizationally gifted.
Rob talked about this on the Form Foundry discussion.
Yeah, but they created structure for themselves.
There is structure, and it's constantly, you know, Steve talks about, man, I got to keep the structure going, otherwise it will just go into chaos sometimes.
Yeah, it would be like a Voltron Lego figure getting dropped on the floor.
Shout out to Lego. Thank
Shout
you.
Shout out to Voltron, man. Yeah, Voltron making a strong comeback. Ooh, About time. I loved Voltron so much when I was a kid.
Yeah, same here.
I'm so pumped because I get to revisit all of these old cartoons that I used to watch. Saturday morning cartoons. I mean, Mask. Not The Mask. Not Jim Carrey, The Mask. Mask, the cartoon.
Yep.
Taft and I have been digging into Mask because I broke out some of my Mask vehicles and action figures for him to play with and destroy, which is tough because I maintain them in pristine condition to this point in my life. But that's okay. That's what happens. You keep them for the next generation to play with and wreck. But anyways,
I feel hesitation when you said that.
No, it's great. It's so awesome to see it. You know, like as a kid, I mean, I wanted to be a claymation artist at one point in my life. Like I was really in high school. I thought I'm going to go into claymation because I loved cartoons. I loved animation. I wasn't gifted enough, or at least I didn't apply myself enough to do animation. And you see what people who are animators. Have you ever seen that Tom Wiltel guy on Instagram? He draws children's books.
I have not.
Oh, he's insane. Nope. And he like challenges himself with like making a drawing a day for a prolonged period of time. And actually, Chris Hornbecker did this as a photographer. He did, I forget what it was called, what he called the project, but he shot a photograph a day for every millimeter of lens that existed. And I think it was like 300 and some, or maybe even went into the 400 some millimeter range of that lens. And when he was doing it, it wasn't like he just stuck a lens on and shot a picture of like a leaf. And he was like, there's my picture for the day. Like every single one was composed. He was looking at all of these different architectural areas in Portland and shadows and light and timing and day and composition. And he was going, and he talked about it. I mean, Chris Hornbecker is like a genius when it comes to photography, right? So I've been really blessed to get to work with Chris, but he was talking about it from the perspective of the toll that it took on his family, because some of these shots were taking 3, 4, 5, 6 hours to execute the right shot with this camera lens. And it's all up on the internet. The whole portfolio of the project. I can't, I'm going to find it just so that people can check this out because it's amazing. Chris is a photographer, is amazing. This project is particularly inspired, but, again, you know, like touching on sort of those cartoons were super inspiring and seeing Taft really, really interested in the cartoons. I'm like, oh, I get that. You know, like I totally get that. Obviously you can't, there's a limit to TV time. An hour a day seems to be plenty, but outside of that, like that creativity and Jonathan Cross talking about being inspired by a lot of sci-fi from when he was a kid in his sculptural work that he does. But, just it's interesting the influences that we have and what they produce themselves as.
I like my sci-fi influence.
Yeah, you're hardcore sci-fi, aren't you?
Yeah, I've got way too much of it. I love it. I say I have too much, but I'm always pursuing more. It's a root of my inspiration in life.
I don't even know how I'd find that project. It needs to really be.
Astrophysics is cosmology is another one that drives my inspiration.
What did you just say?
Astrophysics or cosmology.
Drives your what?
My inspiration. The movement or the large scale motion of the universe or what's going on in the universe.
We're going to have to do a blog post about Chris's website with the 400 millimeter project because that was just, okay. We'll come back to that. Anyways, I can sit and diddle on the phone, but I'd rather rap with you. Yeah. I wonder what you know, the weird thing about bonsai is before getting into bonsai, I couldn't have really cared about trees that much. They got in the way of having to mow the lawn. That's what I know. You know, like the more trees there were, the more sort of angles I had to accommodate with the lawnmower, particularly at the house that I grew up in with my family. We had a bunch of aspen trees. We had like an aspen tree grove and they were constantly and prolifically reproducing from suckers coming out of the roots, which is what aspen groves do, which is what created Pando, the largest living organism on earth in Utah. Anyways, mowing around, you know, like 30 aspen tree trunks down in the yard was a nightmare for a kid who didn't want to be mowing the lawn. And I just thought, man, it'd be a lot easier if we just took all these out, you know?
I was weird. I used to collect acorns from all the oak trees and try to plant them. And every time I got an apple, I used to try to save all my apple seeds. And I tried to plant apple trees everywhere.
You know Johnny Appleseed was a real guy?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I was told about that as I got older because people would know, why are you always taking your apple cores outside and burying them? I want another apple tree. Little did I know that. A lot of times I didn't understand. Well, it wasn't until I got older I understood that I needed light. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I go behind the garage because I didn't want to get in trouble for planting trees. Mm-hmm. And I'm like burying it in the most like shadowed space, like no light at all. There's like no rain getting to it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that wouldn't work.
It wasn't until I got a little bit older. I was like, oh, wait, they need rain. They need water. They need the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got, started planting them all over and then they started growing and. Later on, my grandfather was like, has a bunch of my apple trees and my trees growing in his yard all over.
That's pretty cool, though.
I couldn't stop planting trees as a kid.
Have you ever seen one of those apple trees that has like 30 varieties of apple grafted onto it?
I've always wanted to do one and I haven't, but yes, I've seen one.
I think I'm going to try to do that.
It is so intriguing because to eat apples is fun and I love making apple pie. And you get into the summer or in the fall when they produce, and you got all one type of apple, it gets kind of boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have all those different types of apples, well, different types of applesauce, different types of apple pie, different types of apples to eat.
Yeah, I didn't even go. I was just thinking about the different colors of flowers, but I see where you're coming from now.
I like to eat apples.
I see where your head is at. You're actually talking about consumption.
I love eating apples. It's like my favorite fruit to eat.
Is it really?
Yes, I'm addicted to eating apples.
I don't know that I've ever heard anybody say that apples are their favorite fruit.
Oh, I can't stop eating them. If I go to the grocery store and I'm trying to buy a healthy snack, Or even if I don't buy a healthy snack, I'll buy an apple and a Snickers bar.
And what does that do? Offset the Snickers?
I don't know. It's just...
Okay,
like,
I'm just curious.
I like the crunchiness, the sugariness, and I love the skin. Gets in your teeth and like eating it and the core. I just like eating apples.
Uh-huh.
And I hate oranges, though.
Huh.
I don't like eating oranges.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to go with the mango.
I don't like mangoes either.
They definitely have that sort of furry filaments that get stuck in your teeth. I thought you might engage with that.
No, the pear is the closest thing.
Oh, I like pears too.
So it goes apples and then pears.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you venture, pears are just such a variety.
You know what's interesting is all of the quote-unquote nutritional diets now where you're not allowed to eat fruit, where like fruit is considered a bad thing.
They can get lost.
I don't know. Your fried chicken today, you might consider. I'm just saying.
Hey, I offset it with an apple before I got here.
There you go. There it is. I knew it. It is where it comes from. That's exactly where it comes from. I'm going to eat fried chicken, but I'm going to eat an apple first, and then this is all going to be okay. There you go. I got it. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
And I don't buy one. I like to buy 3 and 4 varieties of apples at a time, too.
Oh, do you? You can like taste test, or just because you like
it? It gets boring eating one apple. They taste so different.
We do need to get you a grafted apple tree.
I love it, man. I like apples.
So you're headed up to Seattle with a white suit.
A white outfit, white suit, and Aaron Packard to go to a Seattle Sounders game.
As a Timbers fan. You know, down in LA, they killed a fan who was rooting for the wrong team at a Dodgers game. That doesn't happen in Major League Soccer.
Well, if it happens, I'll go down in the blaze of glory.
Wow. Representing the Timbers. That's about as hardcore as you can get right there.
I'm not too far from the Army, but I can't speak about my top secret plan I have to go on in the stadium, but I will be well recognized throughout the entire stadium tomorrow.
Wow. Yeah. You have a plan?
There is it's top secret. I can't talk about it.
We're going to need to catch up on this. Now I'm interested.
There will be photos all over the internet of what we're about to do.
Amazing.
Yeah, we have a little top secret group.
Amazing. That's amazing.
We did this last year. And last year we made like 500 flyers or something like that, making fun of all the Sounders fans. And I couldn't get any of the Sounders. I walked around, we call it the clink, and we walked around the clink, couldn't get anyone to take any of the flyers. So I folded them all in half and said, "Free tacos."
Oh,
and I finally
got
everyone to take it.
Nice.
As soon as I said "free tacos," people would open up and then they would read it and they'd throw it to the ground. And the reaction was just priceless.
Soccer fans are hardcore, man.
It was so much fun, dude.
Look at the World Cup. I was listening.
So much fun.
I was listening to a podcast that was talking about Korea beating Germany and how all of the Mexico fans were like hugging these Korean fans in celebration. And I was just like, that's amazing. That's amazing.
It's all right. Yeah.
And then there was a video.
I'm kind of glad they did.
And then there was a video of soccer players beating the crap out of the referees that sort of followed some of that. And that was amazing, too.
From this year?
No, I don't think it's from the MLS. I think it's just on the global scale of like the...
I've seen those videos.
It's a high-stakes game.
Yeah, I've seen some players get really heated out there. But
yeah.
Calm down, man. It is a game.
I mean, they make a lot of money.
They do.
Make a lot of money. Money motivates.
Yeah. I think a lot of them guys like what they're making good money, but they also really love what they do.
Yeah. It was interesting talking to Vitas, where Vitas steps away from soccer consistently. He doesn't watch football, I guess football, doesn't watch it, you know, and is there to play, and that's his job. And then he's got other aspirations in life. I thought that was cool and very healthy, but also it was interesting. It was an interesting perspective. I have never heard I have to be honest, I haven't talked with a lot of professional athletes, so I didn't really know what to think about that. But
he is definitely, I think, a type of player that are like that, but there's a lot that I think just adore it and watch it and suck it up and are absorbed into it.
I couldn't imagine doing Bonsai and then going inside and not thinking about Bonsai again. I couldn't imagine doing Bonsai and not watching other professionals do bonsai, sort of follow their, you know, progress and see what they make. I just can't. It doesn't make any sense to me. But bonsai is obviously not football.
You're a striker in bonsai. How
nobody
about that?
Nobody in bonsai is driving a Ferrari. Okay, let's just establish that. Unless you made your money elsewhere and you decided bonsai was a good idea, which you'll quickly learn is not true.
Although they're their own Ferrari. They're their own Ferraris.
They are. You know, that's an interesting perspective too. They are their own Ferraris, aren't they?
They are way more beautiful than a Ferrari to me.
Yeah, to some people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people love those Ferraris, Testarossas and Lamborghinis and Porsches and fancy cars or you know, well, architecture does kind of, a well-built home does compare to me sometimes. If someone really designs a beautiful home.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I feel like architecture is having a major, major beam of the sun shown on it right now. I feel like architecture is being valued in a way that, you know, and maybe it's just an awareness of it. Because Frank Lloyd Wright really changed the game with architecture.
We're getting bored with the track homes too.
Yeah, I think there's that. And I think as it seems to me, as civilization evolves, that design becomes a more apparent and valuable and obvious place to invest significance. And it really does impact the way that we engage with our built world. Design does.
Yeah. And how we interact with the rest of the world outside of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
As we leave that architectural space.
Yeah.
What our mindset is as we leave it.
Yeah. 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 Architecture is pretty rad. Design in general is pretty rad. It's been interesting to watch in the 8 years I've been in Portland. It's been interesting to watch Portland grow, and Portland became a creative hub, and design in Portland is a very prominent and I think prolific career. And to watch the level of design evolve in Portland, and to see Portland as a city really take on a higher level of architecture. Obviously, Skylab, who we did the Artisans Cup with, has constructed some really prominent structures that are contributing to the skyline and the cityscape now. But beyond that, the Kangokuma Japanese Garden expansion and sort of the air that a Kangokuma structure of that level brought to Portland as a city. And so, I mean, the enthusiasm was there. It was very much there for
that. It was huge. I mean, there is a lot of really good, but there's been some, I hate to go this way, but some of the bad is outweighing it right now for me.
Mm.
As I drive through the city and I see some of these structures they put up, I'm like, why didn't you do a little bit more, you know, soffits or something to add some flair to the building?
It's that extra $300K.
But man, come on, we got to look at that thing.
Yeah. Well, they're thinking we got to afford this thing.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I get frustrated with it.
Design costs, man.
It does.
Design costs. It's time, and you don't realize what design costs until you get into design, and then you're like, oh my gosh, I understand. This is a process, and it takes a lot of brain power, and it takes a lot of logistics, and executing design is a really and the interesting thing about it too is a lot of times it's not tangible. You can't hold it. You can't touch it. A lot of times you just look at it, and it changes. It impacts you. It guides and directs and dictates your behavior. And yet a lot of times you don't know it. It's very...
It's very subconscious.
It's very subconscious. And the more we understand about the human mind, the more that people are able to utilize these tools to manipulate the mind. And you can say manipulate in a negative way for sure, but you can also say manipulate in a very positive way. It's very easy to be attracted to beauty, you know, and well-executed design is...
Like a properly well-done tree and a non-well-done tree.
No, exactly. I mean, it permeates our environment. And I mean, I never really understood how, when Frank Lloyd Wright said he always referenced the land, and when you look at Falling Water as a architectural masterpiece in Pennsylvania... When I went and saw Falling Water, I guess at that time I didn't see how, and I even now I look at it and I'm not really sure how it's inspired by the land, because it's this entirely geometric And they say it's organic design, and I guess I don't still quite understand it. I mean, it hangs over the water, and the water creates air conditioning for the home, and all of that stuff is really neat. But yeah, I don't know. There's levels to the game, obviously.
In your home state, in Colorado, I don't exactly remember where it was. We took a break from tour once, and we went up camping up in the mountains for a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove up, and there was a home literally hanging on the edge of a river, all solid rock, kind of letting the river run past it
mm-hmm.
as you head up into this national forest area to go camping. It was a very moving moment as I crossed this little bridge and I look and I saw this home that just naturally looked like it fit there. And I like falling water. Some reason the design of that home intrigued me more at that.
Mm.
You know, we grew up seeing falling water. I don't know. Yeah, everyone's seen it. It's in covers of magazines. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's in your school books. I mean, I think it's been on the cover of people's, you know, math books and stuff like that.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
But so there was, I wish I knew what canyon that was in. That tree just, or that tree, that home just totally moved me.
Hmm.
They used the rock from the area, kind of naturally laid in there, and how it was on its stilts inside of the river area. It was wonderful. Absolutely. Cool.
I would really care to know more about that.
I will find out where that was.
Please do. Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah. I liked venturing around Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. I was in Las Vegas on Monday.
Ah.
And that would be the anti to all things organic and natural.
Yes, dude. Oh my God.
That place is really wild. They're building the new football stadium because apparently the Raiders Raiders are making the trek to Las Vegas. But the need to build human nature, I guess.
Yeah, we have to. It's gonna keep growing.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. Eventually we'll be building in space.
Ooh. Next frontier.
Yeah. I mean, it's where we got to go.
Is that a Star Trek? Space. The final frontier. Final frontier. Yeah. Ooh. Lime, it's been good to sit down with you, man.
Yeah, you too, brother.
Yeah. Thanks for making the trek out on your way to
Seattle.
Crash the Sounders game.
Yeah. So let's go, Timbers.
Yeah, right. Your sock game is weak as hell today.
No socks today. No socks today.
Yeah, this is like a first.
Yeah. Let my feet air out.
Thank you for that.
Preparing because I'm about to be sweaty tomorrow.
Mm, is it going to be hot up there? Seattle doesn't get hot.
I'm going to sweat the whole time. I have not. So I've only seen us win a Seattle away game one time during the playoffs in 2014, was it? And every other time I've gone up there, we've lost.
Do they have the firepower to get it done?
I have this gut feeling it's going to happen tomorrow. And I'm getting so excited about it that, yeah, talking about it right now, my hands are getting a little sweaty.
That's wild. That is wild. Yeah. Portland's on a roll right now.
We're on a roll. We're doing good, but we can do better.
Mm.
Can always do better.
Spoken like a super fan.
Yeah. We can always do better.
Safe travels, man. We'll catch you on the other side.
Yep. Catch you on the flip side.
All right, man.